You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Hey, everyone. This is Mark Schaefer. Join me, Mitch Joel, Tom Webster, and so many others at this fall's Social Brand Forum in beautiful Iowa City, Iowa. Every person who attends will get a free copy of my new book, The Content Code. Learn more and register now at socialbrandforum.com. Can't wait to see you there.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? Today's guest is Mark Hershon. Mark is Senior Manager of Naming and Verbal Identity in the San Francisco office of Landor, where he's responsible for using storytelling and creativity to develop brand voice, copy, taglines, names, and nomenclature systems for corporate and consumer brands. Mark comes to Landor from Lexicon Branding, where he worked for more than 20 years and served as creative director from 2010 to 2014. During his time, he helped create such memorable names as BlackBerry, Swiffer, and Dasani. As a solo consultant for several years, Mark worked with clients such as Garmin, Sony, and Christopher Ranch to create Nuvi, Crackle, and Monviso, respectively. Mark's creative endeavors reach beyond brand names. His several screenplays produced made-for-TV movies for the Hallmark Channel, including Santa Jr., Monster Makers, and Wedding Days. In 2009, he co-authored a business book entitled I Hate People, a how-to manual on how to deal with difficult people in the workplace. Mark is an award-winning editorial cartoonist for the Half Moon Bay Review, publishing a weekly panel for the past decade and a half. When he's not writing and drawing, Mark can be seen performing and teaching improvisational comedy in or around San Francisco. For the past 3 years, he has also been host and executive producer of Succotash, a comedy podcast that features other comedy podcasts and interviews. Mark, welcome to On Brand.
Thanks, Nick. Happy to be here.
So what did we miss that is not there in your bio? And I'll say that, and I say that to many people, and there's usually some diverse aspect not covered, but we've got movies, we've got improv, we've got naming.
I'm a licensed wedding officiant.
Is that true, or is that your improvisational answer?
That is true. I'm actually heading to New Orleans in a couple of weeks to marry a couple of friends of mine. So I haven't really excelled at doing that. I've only married six other couples, but as I like to say, I'm batting 1,000, no divorces.
I was going to say, you know, that's six more than most of us here have officiated. So obviously, you know, you think about all of this and, you know, your claim to fame, you know, when you look at it, really centers on this act of naming. And, you know, I look at all of this and, you know, I think about, especially when you talk about, you know, your theatrical background of things, you know, you can't help but think of the of Shakespeare's What's in a Name and how tired of you, first of all, of that play on words there.
Oh, my gosh. The worst. Every time I see a naming article that starts with that headline, I just go, oh, boy, here we go again.
Yeah, this is when I silently probably go back through my own blog files, and I'm pretty sure I have something out there that either, if it does not have that headline, it at least includes that reference.
I think probably we all have done it at one point or another in our branding life. It's almost unavoidable.
Right. It's the best way to back into what's really not the easiest topic in the world, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So, I mean, I listed off a few there and, you know, BlackBerry, Dasani, you know, all of these memorable brand names. I mean, how does someone, speaking of that being kind of what you're known for, how does someone end up being known for naming?
Well, I think it has to do with kind of the credentials you create to a large degree, because that's really your calling card. I often will go to parties with my wife, and I like to talk about the screenplays I've written. And my wife goes, "No, no, tell them about BlackBerry." but on the client side, it certainly helps whenever you can kind of reel off a litany of names that they know. You know, there's plenty of brand names out there that are very good brand names, but they're fairly obscure. They might be regional. They might be local. They may not have a big audience. But when you can name off something like a Dasani, then, you know, people sit up and they go, okay, now tell me what you're talking about.
So, you know, in thinking about that, I have to think that the follow-up question is, you know, how's that work? I mean, could you talk a bit about what your naming process looks like?
Well, yeah, sure. A lot of it has to do with the background I have in improvisational comedy, which I actually started doing before I was ever in the branding world. And I started out as a freelancer working for Lexicon in Sausalito, and was invited in. Just I happened to meet the owner of the company at a social event, and he thought my background was interesting. So at the time, they just used all sort of freelancers, which they don't do anymore. And I quickly learned that the way to kind of stay in the game was to really bring in improvisational precepts, which is really the sort of yes and philosophy. You know, you agree with somebody's idea and then you build on it. So in a collaborative effort, the best branding or naming, I guess, in that situation is you learn from other people's names they've come up with, and can you build something from it, either better or just different? And then I just do it in my own practice, you know, just when I'm just naming by myself. I create a list of, say, 20 names, and then I go down that list and try and create five builds to each of those 20 names. And within a very short period of time, I've developed, you know, several hundred names, most of which, you know, frankly, aren't very good. But it's from those ideas that you get the truly great names.
You know, it's interesting because you connected the dots between naming, kind of again what you're known for, and, you know, kind of your history with improv, which, you know, you look at the bio and it seems like that's kind of the interesting, you know,
hobby.
Exactly, but I mean, I actually, you know, I'm a recovering theater arts major, and took some improv classes and know all about yes and I think it's I find it incredibly useful, but it seems like it's rare to find someone else that talks the language. And I just read Daniel Pink's To Sell as Human, and he's got a whole chapter on improv and yes and. I think that it's an incredibly important business skill, and I also teach here at the College of Business at the University of Iowa, and I feel like it's couldn't be farther away from most business and marketing curriculums out there.
Isn't that funny? You know, I actually, one of the reasons, you know, I recently started working at Landor in San Francisco just at the beginning of the year. And I think one of the selling points that that got me in here was the fact that two of the three people I interviewed with had taken a couple of improv classes before. So they were kind of impressed by that. But I also said it's a skill that I can bring to the company. And I've started teaching an after hours improv class here at work once a week and have about 15 people show up, you know, on their own time after work, and they're already beginning to apply it to sort of different disciplines within the branding hierarchy. You know, they're all from different areas in the company. There's some designers, there's some other people that do copywriting, and just even client service people. And I think improv informs the entire array, not just of branding, but anything in business. I'm actually working on a book to sort of bring those precepts more towards the business community. And I used to teach a class here in San Francisco that was improv for business, where I really taught that, you know, every interaction you have with somebody, be it inside your company or a client side, is a performance. And you're either the performer or the audience, and sometimes you're both. But it's really an improvisational exchange that goes on, because nobody has any of this scripted. It's all coming off the top of your head. So how do you build that into a cohesive offering to somebody in the branding business?
So you mentioned a little bit about you know, the yes and building on others' ideas. But what do you find are some of the most applicable improv lessons in business?
Well, it really is. I think the key to improv is really listening. I mean, it really is based on listening and not trying to promote your own ideas over everybody else. There's also the idea of, you know, the old save our scene, SOS, as they used to teach here in San, you know, and it is that. It's like we're all in this together. So if I'm in a pitch meeting with several other, you know, people from my company, I want everyone to succeed. And it's how do you best support them? Sometimes it's just sitting there and, you know, nodding sagely. And sometimes it's jumping in when they're faltering or to bring an extra point to what they're trying to say. So it really is the idea that you're all in this together. Improv is always really a group effort. And although there are certainly performers that improvise on their own, you know, such as, you know, the late great Robin Williams, for instance, it always works best when you're improvising with other people. And that's what business is all about, is trying to do something to get something done with other people. So I think there's that element of listening that's key, and the element of, you know, being ready to jump in at a moment's notice and add something to what's going on.
You know, you talked about, you know, in a pitch meeting scenario of everybody, you know, being on the same side and listing off, you know, some of the different ones that you've been in. Is there one that stands out? Because it's also, I think, aligns with improv, because it's really about kind of creative problem solving. Like you said, we're all in this together. We're all marching towards the same goal. But how do we get there? Is there a story along the way that's kind of jumped out at you? That's you know, kind of one of those classic collaborations.
Well, yeah, I think the collaboration goes, of course, beyond just your own team, because when you're working on a branding proposition, part of the team is your client side, of course. So there's actually kind of two stories, one of which goes back to some of my screenwriting, which is the second TV movie that I wrote for the Hallmark Channel, Monster Makers, literally was something that I pitched to a producer at a production company when he told me that Hallmark was looking for a Halloween movie and did I have anything. And I didn't have anything, but I wasn't going to get pass up the opportunity. So I just made up this idea out of whole cloth, and just, he was my audience, and I just watched his face and his eyes for my cues. When he started to kind of look off to the side or look kind of bored, I would shift gears until, you know, get his interest back. And, you know, I was quickly, probably took 20 minutes to pitch it. And he said, "Do you have that written down?" I said, "Yeah, it's back at my apartment." So I ran home and wrote up a 10-page outline and sent it to him. And 3 weeks later, Hallmark was calling and said, "We need the script in 5 weeks." So that was sort of a personal example. And then one that comes to mind, this was years ago, was for Adobe. And some of your branding people may be familiar with the InDesign program from Adobe.
Yeah.
Well, that was a name that we came up with at Lexicon, but it was not in the deck when we presented it. It was made up in the presentation, literally, as the client was responding to things they liked and didn't like and the names that they were saying. And this was, you know, a first round, so there was going to be another round of work. And I picked up two of the, at the time, we didn't really even do much with PowerPoint, and everything was on cards. And I just bent two cards to create in and design from two different names and put them together and pinned them up on the wall. And they said, "Yeah, that's it."
Wow.
Which is one of the only times that's ever happened in a branding presentation, by the way.
So, like, your worlds colliding there. You improvised really a brand name there in that collaborative setting.
Absolutely, yeah. And like I said, that almost in all my years of doing this, you rarely get a client that says, "Yes, that's the name." You know, it always takes lots of research and lots of number crunching. And
yeah, and now I'll bring in like your other vocation, because if you were going to like write the screenplay about a naming meeting, that's probably how you'd put the scene together, like to magically
yes.
putting these two words together.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Yes. 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 The magic moment that never happens in real life.
Right.
But
right.
But actually did. Once. Right.
Yeah, those great Don Draper pitches that
yes, exactly.
happen just like that all the time.
Just just like magic.
You know, you also, I loved your story there too about pitching that Hallmark idea. I talked about, you know, I think people might look at me if I was crazy, if I, you know, was pitching an idea for an improv course in the College of Business. But now, coming from a meeting where I've talked about some course ideas, I'm sitting here thinking, now why in the hell didn't I pitch that? Because that whole lesson of, you know, you were talking with a producer who in, you know, your business setting, that would be your customer, and you got any ideas, and you don't say no, you'd say yes. And?
Yes, and. Exactly. It's always yes, and.
Yeah. So whether it's, you know, interpersonal communication, whether it's a business pitch, it's a career path. That's
yeah. I mean, I was enlisted by a professor at the University of San Francisco. He was the dean of business and was teaching some MBA postgraduate students who wanted me to come in just based on my stage experience and teach them how to basically perform on camera for doing both talking to the press, but even more importantly, just doing video conferencing. He said, it's unbelievable. I've got these 25-year-olds in my class that don't know how to present themselves on camera. And that became an exercise in improv as well. It was like, yeah, this is important stuff, and it's something that's not really in a curriculum. And so I came in and did a guest kind of lecture and instruction. Then the next year, actually taught as an associate professor that very thing, which was how to literally sort of get your ideas across on camera in a way that was compelling and meaningful, and not just sort of hemming and hawing and not looking down the lens and things like that that most people tend to do in these situations.
Yeah, so in spending time with groups that I often spend time with, students, you know, the workforce of tomorrow, what do you think are some of the skill deficits, knowing that we've kind of talked about the improv side of things, but are there specific skills you think that we're really missing?
Well, I think so. There's some basic interpersonal communication skills that are just dreadful. I mean, I've been working with another professor's students this semester, and in fact, I believe he was on your show, Jonathan Lippman.
Yes.
And so he's teaching a business innovation course this semester, and I came in as a guest lecturer and actually taught him a afternoon of improv, and then took a task as a mentor to take one of the teams. It was a 4-person team, as they were trying to improvise something. They needed to improvise something. And so I challenged them with the idea of how do we get beyond the PowerPoint presentation that's become everybody's stock and trade? You know, I mean, it's people have become yeah. tired of it. I've had literally had clients say, please don't show us a PowerPoint presentation. You know, the challenge becomes, how do we bring names and brands alive without using PowerPoint as our main tool? And just in trying to mentor them, it's astounding to me how badly they communicate. Their grasp of the language is difficult. Just the way they talk one-on-one with people, they don't make eye contact. There's no sort of sincerity. There's all sorts of, like I say, interpersonal communication skills that I think are so key in business, particularly when that business is conducted either over the web or video conferencing, or even harder, of course, is just the audio conference when you're on a teleconference with somebody. To come across in a captivating and compelling fashion is very difficult, and it's become a learned skill. I think it used to be something we all took for granted, but it's really become a learned thing.
Well, it is, and I almost think, you know, you talked about kind of leaning on PowerPoint, and I think it's this crutch. It's this great. It's a wonderful tool when used properly. But I think that it's the same danger why every designer cringes when non-designers get access to Photoshop. That, you know, you shouldn't be cooking up all of those terrible recipes on your own. You should have some sort of training. And I think the same thing. We just dive in. You know, PowerPoint comes with Word and Excel, which for the most part are pretty easy DIY tools, but here's this visual presentation tool, and so many just kind of treat it as an ad hoc teleprompter.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. I've actually shown it. It's amazing in Hollywood that you think would be so forward looking. I've actually taught some of my producer friends down there how to use PowerPoint because they're kind of unaware of it. And they were complaining how much it costs to, you know, create a video presentation of their idea, whether it's a pilot or just a 5-minute presentation. And I said, well, why aren't you just using PowerPoint to do it? They said, what are you talking about? And I would show them PowerPoint and they would be blown away that this simple tool was sitting there waiting to be used and nobody in that community seemed to know about it. One of the things that we're doing at Landor really is trying to show people how much more agile brands have to be today. You know, it's really sort of the core of what they're doing with the messaging here since I started was this idea that because of the new technology, because of all these new ways of communicating, you know, going beyond PowerPoint, how do you make a brand come to life? You know, what is it that's really going to make a brand for a very diverse audience live and breathe? You know, is your brand supposed to tweet? Is it supposed to have status updates? I mean, what is it exactly supposed to do? And I'm finding that in the business setting, a lot of the people who work in this business are sort of suffering the same plight. They're not agile enough. You know, people that have been in the branding industry for, decades for a long time have sort of taken for granted what brands are supposed to do and how they do them. And with all the different media and the audience that knows how to use it, things have really changed. So it's very important from my perspective to really kind of keep up on these things and try and stay as agile as possible when communicating these ideas behind the brands.
Well, and I think when you don't, you know, understand the agility needed or how you bring your brand to life, I think that leads to, I talk a lot about checklist marketing where you just end up doing all of the things because that's what everybody, you know, like you talked about, should this brand be tweeting? And I think that the easy answer is, yep, Twitter's a big deal. Social media's a big deal. So we got to do everything. And I don't know that that's always the case.
That's right. And simply tweeting is not going to solve your problem either. It's just like a brand has to have the brand voice. What is its Twitter voice? You know, and you have to think about these things very carefully. And until you get that straight, no, your brand probably shouldn't be tweeting.
You know, that brings up a good point because your bio talks about brand voice, copy, taglines, names, nomenclature systems. I imagine that a lot of people hear all of those things. They all sound very good. They all nod along. But at the end of the day, it could seem like a lot of words to people. How do all of these words and how we use them really come together to create an agile brand?
Well, it's a very good question. And I think all of them are tools to accomplish that. It's really thinking of through what those words are supposed to be. There's an awful lot of boilerplate in our industry, like you pointed out, the whole checklist thing. And I think, you know, to me, it's an improv performance and each performance is very different. And while there may be shades of similarity between, you know, the presentation you created for, you know, somebody last week and one you're doing for this week, the actual words that you're using are so very important. And that gets down back to my sort of screenwriting thing, which is there's a very specific way to have a character talk. And whether that character is a brand or an actual, you know, next door neighbor in a script, they have a very definitive voice. And I think that's what's not thought through. People talk in very sort of expected, I call them word packages. And they're not really cliches, but they're sort of the way people have combined words for years. And it's really easy to plug them into work, very boilerplate, because, well, this is easy to understand this phrase and everyone knows what I'm talking about. So I'm going to use this phrase. And it just takes a little extra time and a little extra effort to massage that into something that sounds familiar and yet is comes across as brand new and sort of revealing in a different way.
Well, you talk about agility, and I have to think that, you know, brands need to be more agile, but also brand voice, because we've evolved from a place where the only ones crafting the words coming out of our brand's quote-unquote mouth were the agencies, were the copywriters putting together the individual spots. But now as you look at, you know, you have brands that are tweeting, that are active on Facebook, on, you know, there's videos cropping up either produced in-house, out-of-house, and we could end up all over the place. So how do you keep some kind of consistency with brand voice?
Well, it's funny because, you know, when I was at Lexicon, that's a company that really specialized in delivering brand names. And while we did a little bit of this work, you know, in terms of architecture and a little bit of nomenclature and things like that, when I started here at Landor, it became quickly apparent to me that there's a great history here of this idea of, you know what, manufacturer or customer or whoever you are, lean on us for that. Your advertising agency should take its cue from the things we're putting together for you. We will help you to establish that brand voice. And that way you can let your advertiser, you know what it is, know where ground zero is, and start from there. Because I think you're right. What happens is, you know, these ad agencies, they'll lose an account, and that account will go elsewhere, and all of a sudden the brand voice switches dramatically because it was a property of the agency, really, and not a property of the person who owns the brand so much. And so I think working hand in hand with a branding entity, it makes a lot more sense for that agile, kind of adaptive, leading edge information to come from your branding agency. And it sounds like I'm selling branding agencies over advertising agencies, but I think their jobs are, while similar, they're very different. And one of the things we've been developing here is what are we doing now for a social media brand voice? Should, you know, again, are you letting the advertiser do it? Are you letting the owner of the brand just sort of do it willy nilly and assign it to some, you know, 20-year-old that they hired to tweet? Or is there a template in place that you can go, okay, here's really how we should be talking?
And how do you, you know, what's the output there? Because that, you know, it seems like you could, especially as we talk about things academic, you know, we could get lost in like a navel-gazing exercise of what brand voice is. But is it a concise brief? Is it, what's the tangible there?
That's a great question, and it's something that we're always trying to get out of our clients is, what's a great brief? You know, we need a good brief from you guys. And because they don't really speak the language, it's almost like asking them for something that there's no way they can credibly deliver. So you have to kind of help them develop that brief. And the trick about the brief is, I think while it has to be concise, it also has to be living, and it has to be, you know, able and willing to change, both in sort of slow ways and in fast ways, depending what's coming down the pike. It could be anything from a new CEO moves in, and now all of a sudden there's a different direction in place. Or again, an ad agency just changed. How do we shift to accommodate that? So I think it has to be something that's always sort of top of mind, and not something that you write up and then put in a drawer somewhere to never be referenced again.
You know, you talk about, you know, trying to selling the idea of a branding entity, but I really think too, you talk about for someone, you know, brand side, it's a really hard exercise to say, okay, put together your brief on what your brand voice is. It's almost, you know, like saying to a family, you know, write up what your family dynamic is. And, you know, sometimes you're so close to something that you can't see it. You might not be able to put it into the right words.
I think that's a good point. It's almost like we're in the position of being a documentarian, and we're watching the subjects that we're doing a movie about. And then we're the ones that have to kind of put together, here's what it is you're actually seeing, and here's what this all means. Which is why oftentimes now the brief is actually put together in conjunction with the client. It isn't just send us something over transom and we'll start getting to work on this right away. It's like, well, give us some raw materials. Who are you? What's your history? You know, what have you done before? Where do you think you're going? And then, you know, we really synthesize that information and feed it back to the client. They maybe course correct a little bit. And then we have, you know, something we've actually collaborated on that we're all in agreement with. And it isn't some strange piece of writing that we don't know where it came from or what the meaning is behind it.
So in thinking about words and back to names. You know, I got to thinking, you know, in looking at your bio in preparation for our conversation, that you know, something like BlackBerry is a great example of one of those classic brand names, because you look at it and you're like, yeah, that's a solid name. That's great. And you take a step back and you think, how the heck did you end up here? It seems like there would have been all sorts of, calling it, you know, pocket email or something. It seemed like a lot more, you know, rigid, much more finite things that you could have ended up with.
I mean, it gets into a whole sort of worm's nest of different things we could talk about. I mean, one of the things that drives me crazy about the branding mentality today is, you know, when I started doing branding, we were dealing with senior vice presidents and CEOs of major companies. And now typically, you know, you're basically dealing oftentimes with a project manager who has to, send these ideas five flights up, you know, these different convoluted hierarchies, and they don't have necessarily the toolkit you need to sell a name. And we're not ever trying to sell names, of course, but you're creating names and you're hoping they're going to live. If you don't have the sort of tools to be able to make that understood, it makes it very difficult to get a name through the process. BlackBerry at the time was Research in Motion, I think, had 40 employees. You know, it was a very small company, and it still is, you know, in Waterloo, Canada. And, you know, the true story behind the name is that people forget that originally it was just it looked like a pager, and it was basically used to retrieve email from your desktop computer when you were on the road. It didn't have any telephone capability whatsoever. It wasn't part of the original device. You know, when I saw the prototype for this thing, the managing director or the media director was giving a briefing to the company, and we were passing around these non-working prototypes. They hadn't even finished the technology yet, and it was the one I had in my hand was a small black device. It looked like a pager. You remember what pagers used to look like, but they'd cram this tiny QWERTY keyboard on it, these little black rounded buttons, and I just made the casual observation it looked like the high-tech version of a BlackBerry. Which it did. It was just that people kind of nodded their heads. But the interesting thing was the guy from Waterloo, Canada, said out loud, and if he hadn't said this out loud, we never would have known, said, well, that's really cool. And we said, well, what do you mean it's cool? Well, there's no such thing in nature as a BlackBerry, so it sounds really cool. We said, well, what are you talking about? Of course there is. It's a BlackBerry. But the thing is, coming from where he was, from Waterloo, Canada, which is where he grew up, he had never heard the term before because they don't have them there.
Huh.
And when we showed him a picture of a BlackBerry, literally showed him a picture, he said, oh, those are Loganberries.
Oh.
And so to him, what to us was a very ordinary and kind of trite observation, just from the physical look of this thing, was very compelling because to him, it was a whole different presentation of those two words together, black and berry. We generated thousands of names on that project and did, you know, research and all sorts of things. And in the end result, they probably had a dozen names they could pick from. And I think Pocket Link was one of the ones they had to choose from. That BlackBerry one remained the most compelling name they had.
Yeah. And how, you know, it seems like that situation comes up a lot where you've got, you know, probably what may have been a lot of other more literal names, and then that one that can seem like it's out in left field. It seems like a lot of times it goes either way. How do you encourage clients to swing for the fences if there's, you know, all these options, research, everything else to consider?
Well, as my old boss did, Plastic at Lexicon always says, if one of the major things you can do to score points is reposition the competition. And at that time, everybody was doing Pocket Links and all these expected compound solutions. And BlackBerry, when taken the way that they saw it, was not a real word. It was a compound solution. So it fit into that set. It was a compound solution, but it was very unexpected. and it still was able to deliver. You know, they, part of their marketing was that BlackBerry is a vine and it's all interconnected and all these sorts of things. So they kind of took that tact with, you know, telling the story of why BlackBerry was good. But I think in the final analysis, it repositioned everybody else.
You know, talking about things being too literal, do you run into, you know, with things digital nowadays, that we are, you know, so much looking for the search engine juice in our naming that we want to own a particular handle, a phrase, a title, to the detriment of a good brand name sometimes?
Oh, I certainly think so. It goes hand in hand with clients still, you know, really demanding that they have to have a .com, a name that clears as a .com. And the fact is, with so many, you know, new upper-level domains out there, my belief is that the .com thing is going to just fade over time, the more and more these populate the URLs that we use. And so, yeah, I think they are doing them. I think they're doing themselves a disservice. There's just so much clutter around the expected that, you know, they crow today because they get a name that happens to be clear in the one category that they have, but there's, you know, 34 other instances of it out there. Well, are you really getting something new? Maybe in your category you are, but when it comes to that search engine mentality, people still have to wade through all sorts of stuff to find you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's funny how much you run into that .com. Ah, can't, nope, next.
Oh, it drives me absolutely crazy.
So I think about, you know, tools, tabs that I have up when embarking on a naming project. And I think, you know, usually some sort of domain registrar just to see what is available. I also have the, you talked about all the other instances. I usually have the U.S., Patent Office, looking else to see what are there other tricks that you have up there that you do a cross reference on?
Well, you know, one of the things I've started to take a cue from, and I actually did a blog piece about this when it first came down. But you remember when Candy Crush got the makers of Candy Crush, King Games, managed to get the registration on the word candy. And people were just up in arms, and they were able to like squelch a couple of other games that were using candy in their name. And what had happened was they had registered Candy Crush, but then they had a very savvy attorney who went back in time and found a candy registration from a game maker that was no longer making the game, but the trademark was still live. And they negotiated for the sale of that trademark. Wow. And it predated everybody else's mark. And so they were able to squelch those other names. And so that's got me now going back and looking at older registrations and doing some homework and looking, is this product still out there? You know, who actually owns this? Is some holding company now, you know, did they receive this name as part of the settlement, or where is it? And there's such a, as you know, there's such a scramble to try and get a name that can clear that if you can go to somebody that holds a trademark and buy it at a relatively low cost, you've shortcutted a lot of the searching that has to be done because it's an already owned name. So that's become, it takes a little extra homework, but it's kind of astounding if you can hit a home run with that.
So would that be, you know, if you do your trademark search and find that, you know, something that you are looking for is live out there, of just not necessarily taking that as a no next name, but instead digging deeper and saying, who owns this? What are they doing with it? And
yeah, you know, there's a watch manufacturer, and I think they may make other jewelry, but that's what I'm aware of. And they went back and they bought the old Shinola name.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's just kind of interesting. You know, it's got, that name has no relevance for anybody who's under 25 years old as far as it being a shoe polish.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting. And I have all sorts of resources that I, you know, that I love to use, but it all always comes down to, is it going to be available as registration? I mean, one of the resources I found years ago was a gigantic Navajo Indian English dictionary. When I was, I used to live in New Mexico for a brief period of time, and I found it at a record store of all places. And it was from that book that the name Dasani came from. It was a derivation of a Navajo Indian word, which all the Navajo words seem to be about 23 letters long. But based on what Coca-Cola was looking for at the time, you have to do some selective slicing and dicing. But I go, well, here's a name that doesn't exist anywhere else. And so you have to kind of create a lot of things out of whole cloth and then be prepared to tell the story of where it came from. And that's really kind of the only way to sell a name like that. It has to have some kind of history. And it's, again, there's a lesson from all the elements of my background feed each other. And from screenwriting, I know if you can tell a compelling story, you can win an audience over. And the same thing holds with brand names. If you've got a good story you can tell, oftentimes the client will sit there and they'll go, that's very interesting. And they may never tell that story. It's sort of like, you know, Nike. Nike never talks about that being the name of the Greek goddess of victory, but it's still there in their background, you know?
Yeah. Again, the story has to be there, the kind of connective tissue that holds everything together, even if it stays behind the scenes.
I think so. It's almost inherent in the name to have that story back there, lest it all fall apart.
So, your collaborator, Jonathan Littman, mentioned when he was here talking about naming a little bit, I said, how does someone get good at naming? And his answer was name a lot of things, you know, basically to always be naming, as it were. And what advice would you supplement, add to that, say yes and to?
I would say name things a lot, as opposed to name a lot of things. So if you're going to name something, do create a lot of names. I have a lot of people that I've used over the years as freelancers who will kind of come to me exhausted and say, well, here's my list. And it'll be a list of like 50 names. And I'll go, well, where's the rest of it? They go, well, I spent 8 hours doing that. And I go, well, that's not going to help me. I'm used to like churning out, 300 names at a sitting, because you have to do that to get the good names, in my thinking. You can sit there and say, I'm going to scientifically now assemble 20 names, and they're going to be exactly what's in this brief, and it's going to be perfect. And I just don't think it works that way. I can't remember who actually said this, but I agree with it wholeheartedly. Creativity is a messy process. And part of that mess in terms of naming is you just have to be prepared to name things a lot.
Naming is something where volume is necessary to end up, I would think, with something strong. Because I'm sitting here thinking, like your freelancers with their 50. I think so many times when, those of us out there that have embarked on naming something, we've got that legal pad probably with about 50 in it. And hearing you say that 300, I think, is probably... We don't have enough at bats to produce the home runs.
Yeah, and that name, by the way, might be in those first 50 names, but you're not going to know that till you get to the 300 and can look back and go, hey, you know what? Now that I've generated all these names, I can see that there really is value in that name I came up with. Well, look at BlackBerry. It literally was not even a name. It was just an observation. And it ended up going through all those permutations of a naming exercise and weeks of development, and that turned out to be the one.
So in thinking about all of this, I mentioned that we always, as we start to wind down, talk about, brands that have made us smile. I want to ask you two questions, and maybe the answer could be the same, but a variant on that with someone that is naming things a lot. Is there a brand that's made you smile based on something that they've done, and or a brand name that you think, damn, that's a good one?
You told me before we actually started rolling you were going to ask this, and I've been talking so much my brain hasn't had a chance to really think about it. But let me apply my improvisational skills and see if I can come up with something for you. And the first thing that pops out to me, just because I've been considering getting one, is this product called Xoom, and it's XOOM, and it's basically a kick scooter for adults. I oftentimes take the ferry from home, from Sausalito to San Francisco across the bay, and it's about a 5-block walk to my office from the ferry and about a 0.5 mile from the ferry to my home. And oftentimes I'll just walk, But this Zoom thing is like it's a wider platform or deck than you would have on a kid's scooter, and the handlebars come up to where you can comfortably reach them, and it's very sturdy. It can hold like 300 pounds. But there was just something in the simplicity of A, you know, just a slight spelling variation, and the idea of X always kind of spells kind of innovation to me. But the idea that they could get clearance on something called Zoom for a scooter, it's not so much that I think it's a great name, but the fact they were able to get a clearance on it is amazing. So I want to know the story of how they did that.
No, that's I couldn't agree more. It's simple, but it's got that little spin on it too. Plus, I think some people, X equals innovation. And I think part of the reason could be there's so many that are probably afraid of an X. Ah, you don't know how to say it. What will people think?
Yeah, absolutely, all the time.
Any other brands out there that you could think of that have done something else that's made you smile, or is there?
No, I'm just trying to think of, you know, those unusual names that you have to have a story behind, like the name Zynga, which but on its own has a lot of sort of energy and verve to it, you know, for a company that makes electronic games for apps and stuff. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it was the founder of the company's dog's name is always makes me laugh, because I actually made a video years ago of this little animated video. I got so frustrated with some customer stuff once in a while that it was a guy that was just pitching ideas back to a namer or a branding person across the table. But, well, have you thought of the name of insects? Have you thought, you know, all the things you just, yes, we thought of that. What about the name of mountains? Yes, we have. Well, you know, our owner has a dog named Buster. How do you like that as a name? But the fact that that was the owner of Zynga's name, his dog's name was Zynga. And yet, if you didn't know that, Zynga would still be a really cool name for a gaming company.
Yes, it does not help your theory, which is usually that produces eye-rolling results.
Exactly.
But that he actually, it's more that was an amazing dog's name, I think. That's funny. So, Mark, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
Well, they can go to landor.com and look up my bio, which has most of the, I think, everything you said early on. They can go to markhershon.com, markhershon.com. Probably a website I should keep up more, but it's got a lot of the stuff that I do. And then you were kind enough to mention my podcast, Succotash, the comedy podcast. And that is succotashshow.com. And also we're on iTunes and Stitcher and all the other places. I've been doing that for about 3 years now, almost 3.5 years. In fact, speaking of improvisers, my most recent episode I just put up this morning was with Greg Proops from Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Oh.
He's actually a guy I started doing improv with in the mid-80s in San Francisco, and actually enlisted his branding help once in a while. I used to use improvisers years ago, and he was one of the guys that I used to tap. So it's kind of fun to go back to that particular comedy well, and he's a very funny guy.
I'll have to go check that out. He's a very funny guy, top of mind for me too. I just I was listening to this is like multiple degrees of podcast separation, but I was listening to Mark Maron, other Mark with a C,
yes,
and had Kevin Pollak on talking about his documentary Misery Loves Comedy, which he talks to many comedians about many different things, but one of which is Greg Proops. So that's a great show. I think it's out there available via iTunes as well. So
yeah, I'm gonna check that. I actually helped the funding of that. He crowdfunded that documentary, and I pitched in for that.
Well, it is. It was great. I heard about it last week and went straight out and and rented that via iTunes, so the end result is pretty wonderful.
Good. I look forward to seeing it.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to all of that in our show notes. And Mark, thanks for being on brand with us.
Nick, thank you very much. And even though your show is not a comedy podcast per se, I'd love to return the favor and have you on our show one of these days and interview you. How about that?
Absolutely. I would love to be.
That sounds great.
And before we go, I always like to flip the microphone around to our listeners. Want to give a shout out to Dave Cutler all the way out there in Boston, Mass, for his props that he gave this morning for our show with Guy Kawasaki. If you heard something that you liked on this show or another, remember to give us a holler on Twitter using the hashtag OnBrandPodcast, and you may just hear your thoughts right here on the show. As a reminder, you can find show notes, links to everything that we talked about at BrandDrivenDigital.com, where you can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Speaking of iTunes, help a podcaster like Mark and myself out by heading over to iTunes, clicking that star button, give us a quick rating, drop in a couple sentences, help others find the show, leave that rating and review. As always, this podcast is brought to you by our brand-driven digital event series. You can learn more about the industry-leading social brand forum as well as our other workshops and trainings at branddrivendigital.com. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.